You're listening to Unpaused, the podcast for women who want to reinvent their career after an extended break from work or mastermind a new one. Today I'm going to bring you a story that is unfolding on a small Greek island, Syros, where author and economist Ioana Aristide has renovated a run-down neoclassical villa into a jewel box of a hotel of just 9 suites, called Hotel Aristide. Ioana's personal story is a dramatic one. She grew up in Soviet-occupied Romania in her grandmother's care when her parents and sister defected, without her, to Sweden. She trained formally as an economist, a role which took her into the halls of presidential power in Bucharest, before a career in economic advisory in London and Europe. On any reckoning in economics, Ioana had built the foundation of a solid professional career. But she was busy after hours as well, writing and editing a first novel, Under the Blue, which with some prescience describes an epic road journey during a devastating global pandemic brought on by the unanticipated effects of climate change. A few weeks ago, I noticed a substantial piece in the Weekend Financial Times travel section in which the story of Hotel Aristide and Ioana's quest to create it, despite having no experience in running a hotel, much less property investment or historic building restoration, was featured. It was entitled The Accidental Hotelier, How I Quit Economics in London for a New Life on a Greek Island. Reading the fine print, the piece, illustrated with 8 gorgeous glossy colour photos, was also written by Ioana herself. No mean feat in a paper of the quality of the FT. It looked to me like a classic story for Unpaused. Suffice to say, I wrote to Ioana, asked if she'd share her story, and here it is. Ioana, welcome to Unpaused and How Do You Do? Your LinkedIn entry describes you as author / hotelier / economist in that order. But I'd like to cover these in the opposite order, if I may, beginning with your career as a macroeconomist. In your mind, why economics first? And looking back, what do you think was the high point of your time as an economist?
In truth, I wanted to study literature or film directing. And when I informed my family, it's just my family is very small. At the time, it was my mom, my grandmother, and my sister. My mom and my grandmother just started crying. They didn't say no. They didn't try to talk me out of it. They just started crying. They were convinced I would starve. So in the face of that, I decided to go with economics. My objective was I wanted to work in the public sector in Romania. I returned to Romania from Sweden, where my family had emigrated to. I was a bit of an idealist. I thought that I could contribute to Romania transitioning to a market economy. And so I worked for the central bank in the monetary policy department and the modeling department. I was briefly an advisor to the prime minister and the cabinet, but I guess I got disillusioned in time. It wasn't just a matter of adopting the right policies. There was so much politics involved and such a legacy of corruption and just a way of doing things that was incredibly slow and counterproductive. And I realized I risked spending my entire life there, not achieving very much.
But by this stage, as you said, the family had made a decision to go to Sweden and you'd come back to work there. But what was the history behind that exactly? Just for people who aren't quite so familiar with the comings and goings.
My family background?
Yeah, and the political background that your family was coping with.
So my first 10 years I spent in communist Romania. My mother is Romanian, but my father was from Yemen, so he was a foreigner. In general, during communism, the locals were not allowed to travel abroad because there was always a risk that they wouldn't return. But because my father was a foreigner, they allowed my parents to travel, but they could only take one of their children with them. The other had to be left behind as security.
Security, yeah.
Because my sister was younger, she was with them, and they declared themselves political refugees in Sweden. And after the fall of communism, me and my grandmother, we joined them in Sweden. I guess I feel very European. And these sort of the details of my childhood, it sounds, if you see it on paper, maybe it sounds a bit grim that I didn't grow up with my parents. But I thought because I grew up with my grandmother and she was the person she was my parents. So I didn't really suffer from that. I had an okay childhood.
Can you see that there's a definite sort of a legacy from being a macroeconomist? Is there something that you sort of took from that that you think informed the things you did subsequently? Or did you just make a clean break and move on?
Well, I haven't completely left it. After Romania, I moved to London and worked as a macroeconomist, but not in the public sector anymore, for an American analytics company. And in the last years, while I've been on Syros, I've been working as a freelancer. So again, macroeconomic analysis. So I haven't left it behind.
It still pays a few bills,
exactly.
Maybe.
Very important income in this pandemic. So no, I haven't left it behind. The main thing about economics, I shouldn't speak for everyone, for me, is it makes you very pragmatic. It's about what works. It's not an exact science. The theory is, most of it is speculative, because we have lots of models, but the only functioning model would be a replica of the actual world. So everything is a simplification. But in economics, you have to go with what works, not with what, you know, with wishful thinking, or you'll just achieve bad results. So maybe that's something that I've taken from that discipline.
Let's talk about Syros and your evolution into becoming a hotelier, which I would have thought, I suppose there's an overlap there, but in that you have to be very practical and a lot of planning goes into running a hotel. But if I went back to the first part of the story, you set out to buy a family holiday home, as I understand it, on a Greek island and ended up with a project.
Yes, so it was definitely not planned. We were holidaying on Syros. I had been there a few times. I spent 5 summers summer holidays in a row on Syros. And when my mom and sister came, they loved it too. And they said, well, we all like it. We're likely to return. Why don't we buy a holiday apartment? My sister also had some money that she wanted to invest. And it just got almost absurdly out of hand, where we fell in love with this neoclassical villa that was far beyond our budget, had nothing to do with the idea of a holiday apartment, and that we couldn't buy except as a business. We still don't have a holiday apartment.
So, I mean, I suppose you can't have a holiday there, really. It's work, isn't it? But in a dreamy environment. Why was the town of Hermopolis so special, the place where your villa is? Talk about the history of that town and also why it's still special.
Well, its relatively recent past is very special. It became, in the late 19th century, by because of coincidence of factors, it became almost the capital of Greece and definitely the industrial and mercantile capital of the Eastern Mediterranean. There was the Greek War of Independence, in which Syros declared itself neutral. So it meant that lots of refugees came to the island, and these refugees were often wealthy families that had an interest in shipping or in textile industry. And they all moved to Syros and rebuilt the capital in the style of a much grander place. For about 80 years, I think, Syros was important almost globally. And you can still see this in the architecture of the island. There are marvel roads, marvel pavements, palatial buildings. The town hall could fit a city the size of, I don't know, a few million. It's just not a typical island in that sense.
And it had a university, I think.
It still has a university, industrial design and some visual arts. So that means that there's not just a university in general. It means that it's busy even in winter. Bars are open, restaurants are open. It feels like a real place. It doesn't feel like a touristy place.
It's got quite a strong artistic presence there, as I understand it. Music is very strong there, and you have festivals and artists and the like.
Yes, music is definitely the main art form, because a Greek singer and composer of the music style called Rebetiko is from Syros. So there's a legacy of this type of music, but there's also classical music, jazz. And I noticed that so many of the people I know here, they play an instrument or they sing or they dance.
I mention it because I recently interviewed here in Australia Annabelle Hickson, and she's just started a magazine, which one of the themes of the volume we were talking about was why some cities fade and some flourish. And so much of it is driven by the artists and the culture that effectively takes refuge in these small towns and then changes them for the better and stops them from losing their sense of purpose.
Yes, it has been the case here as well. I think the sort of residual wealth and just cultural history, because Syros also had a theatre, an opera. It has trappings of an important place. And I guess it attracted artists. And once you have a critical mass of people with those interests, just attracts more.
And how would it compare, for instance, to Mykonos, which I think is nearby, which is obviously a tourist hub?
I think they might as well be on different planets. It's completely different. The way they look, Mykonos is the, I think, looks like the sort of Greek island that most people are familiar with the white cycladic houses with the blue window frames. It's very picturesque, but it's extremely touristy. I think in summer it has, at any point in summer, there are 300,000 or 400,000 people on Mykonos, and it has a local population of 500. So, I mean, 500 people compared to 300,000 tourists.
Yeah.
I haven't actually properly studied it, but my feeling is that it has lost its local identity and it's just a place famous for being famous. We wanted to do something we liked. We didn't start. The idea of making a hotel wasn't per se particularly attractive. The idea of making a hotel on this island with these people was what was interesting to us. And also the sort of tourists that Syros attracts, they're generally not the tourists who would go to sort of all-inclusive tourist resorts and who just want to go clubbing or something. It's just, it's not that kind of island.
So if we came to the hotel, you bought your villa and it was not in great condition?
Structurally, it was in a good condition. There were no issues with the roof or any, you know, stability issues, which was very, very good and unusual. I think this was because that the house was fairly recent compared to other neoclassical mansions. It was from the late 20s, so by then they had used better construction methods. And it's just less time had passed since it was built. So we didn't have those problems. But everything else, windows, doors, plumbing, electricity, everything except the actual walls had to be changed or refreshed.
And so I just get the sense you are a sort of a paradox in that you do a lot of research and thinking. You took a lot of time with every decision you made. You wanted to understand what all the different factors were. But I also read that you spent 7 times your budget. How do you sort of reconcile those two things, especially to someone with a background in economics? And what would you say to someone thinking about taking a leap of faith like that into a new venture, having had the experience you've had?
I think we have to get back to our grandmother, who was herself very ambitious, and at a time when it was quite unusual for women to have a career. She was a judge. And what we have from her is that something has to be absolutely extreme for us to think that if we would like to do it, we cannot. So once we had the idea that, oh, we would love to have a hotel on this island, and there was a small chance that we could do it, we just went with it. But of course, it was much, much more difficult than we thought. And I didn't know at the beginning that I didn't know how much restoration would cost. Also because the project itself got more ambitious as we went along.
So you have been quite ambitious. You came up with this idea, not just for it to be a hotel, but for it to be your dream hotel. What's the difference in your mind?
The difference is if you spend a lot of energy for something you do just once in your life, you can't make it perfect for everyone or maybe perfect for anyone else, but you want to do it so that you feel completely at peace that you've done the best you possibly could.
And so who were your main collaborators? Because I can see that either you've got an amazing eye for design, or you've brought someone in, or you've worked with someone, or a series of people who really do. Because I recognise a few bits and pieces in there that I know are special. And the artwork and the themes that you've worked around with, you know, art and a place for an artist in residence, etc.
Thank you. So we had an interior designer who designed 90% of the bathrooms and the bar, and the rest we did. My mother and my family are very much into design, and they're responsible for most of the details. And I had sort of the big picture approach about themes, and the theme with a different marble, in a different Greek marble in every room, and the artist studio. But it was, with the exception of the bathrooms, it was our design.
It's beautiful. And I must say, the website is a feast for the senses. There's a lot of information there, but also it's very beautifully done. The jewel colours and the depth of field. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you.
So at what moment do you think you really turned into a professional hotelier? What was the day you woke up and thought, wow, I'm really doing this?
Well, that had to happen last summer when we partially opened. Works were delayed because of the lockdown, so we didn't finish the whole hotel, but we finished half the rooms, the public spaces and the gardens, so we could open. And I think it takes time before you get into the mindset of, you know, what's important, what to prioritize. Also the interaction with the staff. I'm not a natural manager, I think. one of the reasons I prefer literature to other art forms is that it's something that I can do on my own and doesn't depend on anyone else. I think this has been for me the deepest learning curve, to collaborate, to learn to delegate, not necessarily to trust people because I trust people, but to not to try to do everything myself.
And was there any formal learning, or did you just rely on experiences of great places you'd stayed? Did you have any mentoring or formal study that informed how you're running the whole place?
No, I read some books. We hired two hospitality consultants who advised us, but mainly about the bar. And I spoke to some hotel owners that I admired, one in particular in Stockholm, a small hotel called Ethem.
Oh, yes, I know Ethem. Yes. Very nice.
A beautiful hotel, yeah. And the owner was very, very, very kind, and she spoke to us about her experience. Places like Ethem, it's more difficult for them because they're not in Greece has sun and sea, and a lot of hotels just get away with here's a bed. So I don't think the standard is necessarily very, very high. They haven't had to try to make the experience of actually staying in the place special because it's so nice outside.
That's right. There are other places to be. What about, I know your sister is a doctor. I think, is she still working as a locum in the Arctic Circle?
Yes, sadly.
But what difference did it make having a partner in the venture? If you had unlimited money, would you have preferred to have done it on your own, or have you enjoyed the whole experience of being in partnership with her?
It's definitely been good, and there's no way I could have done it without her. We're very different. I'm, believe it or not, but I'm more cautious and she's even more adventurous, and I don't think I would have aimed quite so high considering our financial situation at the time. But she was adamant that it'd work out somehow.
I know you've sort of said that you're not really so comfortable with many people, but the hotel, the creation of the hotel brought you in touch with many professionals who needed split-second decisions, which must have been very stressful. How did you sort of manage the stress? How did you cope with that decision overload that people get even when they're renovating a house?
It was very stressful, and part of me is just, well, you started this, you have to finish it. So it doesn't really matter how stressed I feel or how tired I am. I've always had the writing. That's always helped me de-stress and just take my mind off other things. I think I've been lucky to have that as a completely different focus from the hotel and the problems of restoring the house.
It is amazing that in the midst of all of this, or even before this began, you'd started your first novel, and now it was published a month ago. So through this whole period, you've actually written it and pitched it and had it published.
And edited it.
That's right. I mean, how, just in purely practical terms, how did you fit planning and writing a novel into this whole program? What was your typical day like?
Well, I was very lucky that Greeks wake up at around 10. And so I didn't have any contractors on to see before 10, 11. And I could, especially in summer, it was very easy for me to wake up early, like say 6, and get in some hours of writing and then go to the hotel.
And did you find it of a painful process, or did it come quite easily to you?
I spent about 6 months just thinking about it and planning it, because I had, before I wrote this novel, I had written another one that I was never happy with. And I think I spent 3 years trying to get that to work. And I felt I had painted myself in a corner in some senses. I plotted this out and thought about it before I started writing, just to make sure I wouldn't reach a dead end.
It's called Under the Blue, and I think we have to talk about what it's about, because it's intriguing that you began this in 2017, long before the word pandemic became so fundamental to our conversation.
The background to the novel is a global pandemic that starts in 2020 in Asia. In the novel, it spreads around the Olympic Games. But this is the background. It's not really about a pandemic or about an attempt to solve it. It's a road trip. These three characters have to flee Europe to Africa. And in the other narrative strand involves two scientists who are trying to teach an AI to predict the future, in the sense of predicting crises that might affect humanity and so help prevent them.
But in the first narrative about the road trip, the pandemic started because the permafrost melted and a carcass of a reindeer was exposed and the virus was embedded in the remains of the reindeer. So there is a strong environmental theme.
Yes, absolutely. That was my motivation for writing that story as a warning of where environmental destruction will take us. This scenario is very realistic. It has happened before, but it just hasn't happened with a very aggressive virus or bacteria. But it has happened with anthrax, for instance.
Yeah. And were you actually writing the novel while the pandemic was unfolding? And did you have this
sense? No, I was editing it.
You were editing it. But did you have this sense of, oh my God, I'm really onto something here?
It wasn't, oh my God, I'm onto something. God, I hope it's not as bad as in the book. It wasn't good for the novel that it coincided with this because, well, one thing is that whenever me or the publisher speaks about it, we always have to start by explaining that it was written before. We're not trying to take advantage of this tragedy. So that's one aspect. And the other aspect is that people don't really want to read about anything that has to do with the pandemic.
I know, but it's so interesting, I think, coming from the environmental angle, because that's definitely informed the way you operate the hotel, for instance. Just looking at your website, you've got quite a strong feeling about doing things more responsibly, more sustainably.
Yes, we're trying. It is an attempt to mitigate. I don't know if this sort of restoration in an urban environment can actually be completely environmentally friendly. I mean, just cement is a horrible thing, but we're trying to mitigate this by not using plastics in the hotel, by having recyclable materials everywhere. We have this tree planting project that is very slow to take off, but then again, we haven't really had guests. So I hope that this year I can actually show some trees. So yes, we're trying.
So if I was to go back and trace the arc of your career, I see a scientist, an artist, and a business person all rolled into one. What do you think is going to happen next? What's the plan?
Well, definitely in the short term, I have to make sure that the hotel survives the pandemic. And then I would love to get back to writing. I think I'm happiest when I'm writing.
So the book's only very new. How's it going? I saw that you'd only just received your own first copy of...
Yes, my copies were stuck in customs since January, I think because of Brexit. So I hadn't seen it until 3 weeks after publication date. It's a good feeling.
Yeah, that's exciting. It's been great to talk to you, Anna. Congratulations also on the publication of Under the Blue. And I hope it goes well and that the novel is the first of many.
Thank you very much.
It's easy to see why I was drawn to Oana's transition from economist in Romania, a place where she realised she was at risk of spending her entire life and not actually achieving very much, to hotelier on an idyllic Greek island, just as the unprecedented global pandemic begins. Not even the allure of the fledgling hotel's location, the culture of Syros, or its gorgeous fit-out would be enough to meet the threat of COVID, all so far beyond her control. What relieves the apprehension of disaster is Oana being able to fall back on freelancing as an economic analyst and her writing and deft skills as publicist to help pay the bills while the pandemic plays itself out. On top of that, whether it was good timing or bad, the novel's publication last month and its subject matter gave Oana the perfect platform to put herself squarely in the public eye, just as the intra-Europe travel situation begins to look more promising. And as she promotes the book, she's well placed to talk up the hotel project too. There are important synergies here, pointing to the value of a more diversified career approach. What do they say? The career of the future looks more like a portfolio than a path. I can see from Twitter that sales of Under the Blue are doing well. Right now, she's tracking fourth in the most wished for category for books with visions for the future on Amazon. So for now, everything seems to be working out. Thanks to Leonie Marsh and Jason Milhouse for help with this episode. There are links to Hotel Aristide and Under the Blue and that FT article on our website, unpaused.net. Until next time, farewell.